Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument in Jones and McKinney versus Fletcher.
May it please the court, I believe that what we are faced with here today is nothing new to this court because it is in fact a continuing search for a deep pocket. And in this instance, it is a search for the affirmance of a judgment by the respondents that imposed liability on Edward D. Jones and Beau McKinney in connection with a transfer of stock and imposed liability on Beau McKinney and Lincoln National Life Insurance Company with regard to the establishment and liquidation of an annuity. The facts, I think, while we've stacked up a lot of paper and killed a lot of trees, the facts are relatively, I believe, simple. In 1989, September of 1989, Beau McKinney, who is a securities representative for Edward D. Jones, was contacted by a fellow by the name of Carlton Annis. Carlton was a nephew of a lady named Ms. B. Cairns, and he said that his aunt wished to transfer securities to him.
Let me just interrupt you.
Yes, ma'am.
Those securities were where? Were they being kept by the stockbroker?
It changes, Your Honor. At the time that Mr. McKinney witnessed the signatures, which was a part of transferring the securities, those securities were in the possession of Ms. Cairns at her house where Mr. McKinney went. Subsequent to that time...
But before that time, were they being held by Edward D. Jones?
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. As a matter of fact, I think all the record will reflect, Judge Spector, is that the first time you hear any reference to the location of those securities, they were in the possession and control of Ms. Cairns at her house. There also was some testimony from Ms. Fletcher and others that at times those securities were in a safety deposit box in Ms. Cairns' name in a bank.
Okay.
But these were not securities being held in a street name by Edward D. Jones or in a custodial account by Edward D. Jones. The evidence will show that Mr. Annis suggested to Mr. McKinney that he had a power of attorney and he would utilize the power of attorney to transfer the securities. Mr. McKinney indicated that he was uncomfortable with that and he preferred to visit with Ms. Cairns, the aunt. Sometime 2 or 3 days or sometime after that, an appointment was made where, because she was in a wheelchair, Mr. McKinney went to her home. The evidence in regard to what took place in that home visit is uncontroverted. There were only two people who testified who were present. That is Beau McKinney and Mrs. Annis, who was in an adjoining room, the wife of the nephew. And the testimony there is that Mr. McKinney visited with Ms. Cairns. He talked to her about what her desires were. He visited with her about what the consequences of her transferring of these shares would be, that she would no longer be the owner of them, and that she would not receive the income from them. And that she, on 2 or 3 occasions, indicated she desired to go through with the transaction. Also, there is testimony, uncontroverted, that at various times, Mr. McKinney asked her if she wished to stop and resume at some other time, and basically I think her response is reflected in the record was, no, let's go on and complete it. This went on, I believe the record will show, from about 7 to 11, 7 to 10:30. There may be some slippage in what it shows, but about 3 and a half hours. At the conclusion of that time, Mr. McKinney, as a result of that, had set up an account in her name, which was necessary in order to effectuate the securities transfer. He had, or had gotten the papers to set that account up. She had signed the necessary stock powers, and he had witnessed and guaranteed her signature as is required by most transfer agents. He then took the securities back to his office. He similarly set up an account for Carlton Hannis. The securities were then sent to Edward D. Jones in St. Louis, where in accordance with standard practice, after the transfer was reported, the original certificates at some point are destroyed. Now, nothing happens with regard to the securities, as far as the record shows, or with regard to any yow-yow between, as far as Bo McKinney is concerned, or Edward D. Jones, until in January of 94, Mr. Hannis comes in and says these dividends are eating him up on his taxes and he wants to know what he might do to save on taxes. Mr. McKinney is a service representative for a number of insurance companies, and he suggested to him that he could put it in an annuity with Lincoln National Life Insurance Company, and the earnings from that annuity would be tax-free until Mr. Hannis began to draw them down. Mr. Hannis wanted to do that. Stocks were liquidated pursuant to that investment, and the investment is made. There is another substantial stretch of time in January of 90 when that was done. And then in September of 1990, there is an application made to appoint Ms. Weaver, a niece, as the temporary guardian. Now, as far as the record reflects, Bo McKinney and Edward D. Jones have had, and Lincoln, have had no contact with anybody in this deal between January of 90 when the annuity is set up and September of 90. In September of 90, pursuant to that temporary guardianship, a constable of Milam County delivers a writ of sequestration and attachment to Bo McKinney in his offices in Taylor, Williamson County, Texas. It is uncontroverted the constable removed nothing physically from the premises. At a later point, he requests through Mr. McKinney's secretary, I believe the testimony was, a list of what it is that I seized. Whereupon a list is made up of the securities held in by Edward D. Jones. And there is attached, I believe, to that response on Lincoln National Life Insurance Company letterhead, a notation with regard to the annuity. Mr. McKinney then is called and testifies in a guardianship hearing. In the course of that testimony, when he's talking about what Edward D. Jones holds, he volunteers that there is other property, that being the annuity held by Lincoln National Life Insurance Company, and the contract being held by Mr. Hannis. Now, in October, on October the 14th, 1990, the second guardianship hearing, if I'm correct, was on 9/21/90. Like a first guardianship, 9/21/90, then the Mr. Hannis on 10/14/90, by overnight letter to Lincoln National Life, requests surrender of the policy. Now, all of this, and the policy subsequently surrendered, Lincoln sends him the money, Mr. Hannis runs over to East Texas to Mr. Dyer, gives him the money, Mr. Dyer puts it in his name in a Louisiana bank. Now, all of these transactions and transfer of the property about which there was a complaint in this case had been the subject of an earlier lawsuit, a will contest, and a lawsuit against Carlton Hannis. In that will contest, a will dated, I believe, December the 15th, 1986, was declared to be the valid will of Ms. Cairns. That same order, in connection with the imposition of $1.7 million in liability on Mr. Hannes, found that from December the 16th, 1986 forward, one day later, Ms. Cairns was mentally incompetent. She was NCM.
I thought the consent decree said that she was incompetent at the time of the stock transfers.
The consent decree said that she was incompetent, I believe, Your Honor, and I'll go back and read it, from 12-16, because it struck me that the judgment finds that she is competent and that her will, dated 12-15-86, is admitted to probate, and yet 24 hours later, she is incompetent. And in the course of this trial, the judge lets that judgment in, at first under a cautionary instruction, that it is not admitted for the truth of the matter stated. Subsequently, on at least two different occasions, he treats that judgment as though it is there for all purposes. Now, to get to the nub, we objected at the time this case was submitted to the jury that there was no evidence to support a finding on the negligence issue or on the fiduciary duty issue. We also made those same objections to various of the other negligence findings. We objected on the basis that this issue that was submitted that said that Bo McKinney had lied to the court about the effect of the writ the court had issued, that there was no cause of action. And we also said there was no duty of good faith and fair dealing in the context of this case. Here's the problem we had at that stage. We were confident there was no evidence that would support a negligence submission with regard to anything that was a duty of Bo McKinney. We did not dispute that he had a duty, as any agent would, to carry out the instructions of Ms. Cairns, to carry them out reasonably promptly, and, obviously, not to be negligent and not do what Ms. Cairns had told him to do. There is no evidence in this record if those were the only duties that he breached any of them. As a matter of fact, if you look at the trial court record in this case, all of the evidence in the trial court was over what Bo McKinney didn't do, such as call her doctor and ask whether she was competent, call her neighbors and ask whether she was competent. All of the things he didn't do, and then some things that other people, psychologists and Ms. Fletcher and others testified that he might have done. We objected on the basis that there was no evidence that would support a finding of negligence, and necessarily we got into the duty question. Counsel for the respondents has been unable yet to cite a case in which an agent is required to determine the competence of his principal before carrying out the transfer.
Any other questions?
Let me ask a question real quick about the waiver issue.
Yes.
I think you were alluding to
it. Yes, sir.
Have we had a chance to see the handout that they provided us?
Your Honor, I got that this morning at the oral argument, but I've read it. Yes, sir.
Basically, it's just a reiteration of some arguments made previously, but what is your response to their comment that neither Edward D. Jones or McKinney's objections to the charge, their motion for Jan Ove, nor their motion for new trial, raise an issue concerning the limits of any tort duty owed by a stockbroker?
Your Honor, I don't believe that is accurate, because I think that in the objection to fiduciary, there was a combination question, negligence and fiduciary duty was question two. In that, we specifically noted in that objection that there was no fiduciary, unlimited fiduciary duty. We had the problem, as I was trying to explain a while ago. We could not say, either as to negligence or fiduciary duty, because we were an agent, that under no circumstances would we have a duty. What we did clearly point out over the course of the trial, in the motion for new trial and in the motion for judgment NOV, is that there was no evidence to support a finding with regard to that issue.
With, well, that gets to kind of the point of what
that's right.
That is, if I understand it, you did make valid, good objections with regard to the factual sufficiency supporting those conclusions. But you did not challenge the legal basis of the submission.
I submit that we did, Your Honor. We challenged it in the only way we could in the way the case was submitted. Had we, for example, had we made an objection, Your Honor, question number two should not be submitted because Bo McKinney had no duty not to be negligent with regard to Ms. Cairns. I think most people would have laughed you out of the courtroom with that objection. What we had to say was, is that the evidence these plaintiffs have adduced is not evidence of the breach of a duty, and therefore negligence or not, it couldn't support an answer to question number two.
So you're claiming then that it was not incumbent upon you, either at the charge stage, the JNOV stage, or the new trial stage, to argue that legally there is no duty?
I do not think it is incumbent on the circumstances in this case. And I think we would be entitled to prevail. I think you said we challenge factual sufficiency. I think we challenge legal sufficiency because we basically said there is no evidence that will support an affirmative answer to question number two and all the other questions. There are other questions, again, there are other questions where we specifically said that there is no such duty. For example, the question of whether we lied to the court, whether Bo McKinney lied to the court about the effect of the court's writ. We said that. But in the context of the questions being asked here, I believe what we raised was the proper way to raise it. And to the extent they now try to say, well, look at all this evidence of what he didn't do, then my answer to that is all of that evidence relates to something that he had no duty to do. It all relates to the duty to investigate or accurately determine her mental competence.
Any other questions?
If Ms. Cairns was obviously incompetent, at least to the point where a reasonable person in Mr. McKinney's position would have reason to suspect her of legal competence, would there be any duty under those circumstances to do anything further, or could they just go right ahead and sign her up?
Your Honor, I've troubled over that a great deal. But I have decided that I believe what is appropriate under the concepts of duty that this court submits is that once you say that a layman like Bo McKinney has to be able to make a determination that both doctors and lawyers argue about endlessly in trials, about competence, incompetence, what it means legally. It seems to me that to put that kind of burden on an agent is going to substantially impede commerce. It does not mean that it's without remedy, because the transaction can be set aside, and to the extent that Bo McKinney or Edward D. Jones obtain any benefit from it, they can be required to disgorge it. That's a risk I think you would run and deal with somebody who might be obviously impaired. The cases that we've cited in our brief that deal with the securities instances are situations in which people had been found incompetent at various times. They were not under an existing adjudication of incompetence, and the courts in those instances found the broker had no duty with regard to it. And I think that's the proper rule.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear an argument from respondents.
May I please the court, Mr. Aaron Jackson, and an argument for respondents.
May it please the court. My name is Aaron Jackson. I represent Pat Fletcher, the respondent. I think that the questions that the court has in this case must be determined in the factual context of the case. And I'd like to say that although the facts are not complicated in the case, that the two sides do disagree about what the facts were in the case. And in this particular case, the rule is clear that with respect to the two no evidence questions, should you reach them over the waiver problem, points of error 2 and 4, the two no evidence points that you have granted the writ on, the rule is that all of the evidence unfavorable to the jury findings in question must be disregarded, and further that all reasonable inferences in support of those findings must be made if those inferences have more than a scintilla of support in the record.
But that, of course, would not matter if we concluded that there was no duty.
That's correct, Your Honor. You don't reach the no evidence points if you conclude that there's no legal duty. And I have a response to that, but I don't think you can determine whether there was a duty in a vacuum. I think that the question of duty in all of the cases that the court has decided, from Graff v. Beard of 1993 to the most recent case, the Boy Scouts case just last year, have determined the question of duty in factual context. Now, those cases were summary judgment cases. And we have a different case here. In those cases, the court was not called upon to assess the credibility of any witness or to make any inferences in support of any findings. They didn't have to. The inferences were all the opposite direction.
Let's assume that my mother has done business at a bank for a number of years and she's failing mentally, and she walks into her bank one day and talks to her banker and instructs him to empty out all of her accounts and give away all of her money to a wildlife fund, for example. And the bank suspects that she's not mentally competent. What should they do at that point? Do they owe a duty to her children to pick up the phone and call her? Or call them? What's the duty of when someone that you deal with, you suspect that they don't have any effect?
Well, I think the short answer to your question, Your Honor, is to act like an ordinarily prudent person would act under the same or similar circumstances. And that was the definition of negligence submitted to the jury in this case, and the jury found that Mr. McKinney had not acted that way. The specific case that you posit is not before the court.
Are you putting people who deal with the elderly in peril? Do they have to determine before they will deal with the elderly, get some certificate or some, I guess, proof that the person they're dealing with is legally competent?
No, Your Honor. I do not believe that that is the duty.
How can they protect themselves otherwise if they deal with the elderly?
I'll tell you how they do. They pay attention to what they see. They utilize the knowledge that they had. As in the Boy Scouts case, there's no investigation required by the Golden Spread Council. But they do have to act reasonably given the knowledge that they have. And the evidence in this record properly construed is that Ms. Cairns, Aunt B, exhibited signs of incapacity that even a layperson would have recognized as signs of incapacity. It's undisputed at this point in the litigation that Aunt B was legally incompetent on September 28, 1989. That finding is not before you and it can't be before you. It is a fact as we stand here. And the evidence properly construed in this record of a judgment based upon a jury verdict is that Aunt B exhibited signs of her incompetence that a layperson would recognize. And so the duty is that if you see signs of incapacity that even a layperson would recognize as signs of incapacity, you should refrain from conducting business with that person because we protect people who are lacking capacity.
Well, in the protection, the remedy of setting aside the transaction?
That is the situation with a will, Your Honor, where you have the procedural safeguards of probating the will, where before that document can take any effect, before it has any impact on the person's estate, procedural safeguards must be employed that are designed to protect against the possibility that the person might have been incompetent.
But doesn't the guardian appointed to an NCM person have the right to bring such an action as a remedy to set aside a transaction claim to be made while she was incompetent?
Yes, Your Honor, but the crucial distinction here is that in transfers like these, there is an immediate effect on the person's estate. And the guardian may sue when she finds out later. And the money may be gone, just as in this case. But in the other situations that you're talking about...
Well, you say the money was gone. But Edward Jones Company was still there, solvent.
That's correct? Why we sued them, because the stockbroker was required for this transaction. Justice Spector asked, where was the stock? And that's the crucial question. If this stock were already in a brokerage account and a street account, and it could be transacted over the telephone or by facsimile, we wouldn't have this case. But that stock was in Aunt B's safe deposit box.
Would you explain why?
Why she
had it. If these were instructions, if Aunt B called on the telephone, called Mr. McKinney and said, I want to transfer $300,000 to the stock, why wouldn't you have a case?
He doesn't have any opportunity to observe her. He spent
did he
four
under,
hours.
Is he under some duty to inquire or investigate?
Well, again, that case is not before you. I think in that case, he might
we're,
not
we're
be.
We're testing the breadth and depth of your duty you're arguing for.
The narrow duty that I'm arguing for, Your Honor, is that when a man goes out and meets in person with a lady who is, it's undisputed, legally incompetent.
Who said she was legally incompetent? What is this undisputed evidence you rely on of her incompetence on the date of the transaction?
The jury's finding in response to question number one, which has not been challenged since the trial court.
Well, I understand the jury may have found something, but you've alluded to uncontroverted evidence that she was incompetent. If it's uncontroverted, you don't submit that question to the jury. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. I didn't mean to say uncontroverted. I meant to say at this stage in the litigation, it is undisputed. It cannot be disputed. It has to be taken as a given that she was incompetent.
And why is that?
Because they haven't challenged the jury finding. And so when you ask, for instance, will this chill business with the elderly? My response to that is, it should chill business with the incompetent elderly.
What if a gentleman comes in, again, he's dealt with a bank for a number of years, and he has some signs that he might not be in possession of all of his faculties, and he's entered into a large contract, and he asked the bank to transfer funds to perform that contract. Now, if the bank's kind of put between a rock and a hard place, aren't they? They don't make the transaction, would they be subject or could be sued for
in this
breach of fiduciary duty interference? But if under your duty theory, aren't they liable if they did make the transaction and doesn't have to the width of that?
I think that would present a difficult case, Your Honor. But in this case, Mr. McKinney, Bo McKinney, voluntarily undertook, as in the Boy Scouts case where there was a voluntary undertaking that then created the duty of ordinary care at minimum, Mr. McKinney voluntarily undertook to do this transfer. He did not have to do it. She was not a customer of his. He hadn't even talked to her before he hit her doorstep at 7 o'clock that evening. And so all he had to do when he observed the signs of incapacity is just say no.
How does that differ? Is there a difference between the stockbroker and I believe it was Fletcher who returned all of the financial records to Aunt B? Did Fletcher have a duty not to allow those records to go back to Aunt B?
I think that that's a question that we struggled with at trial, Your Honor. And my response to that is that, first of all, the jury found that she was not negligent in the way that she acted. And I think that the evidence in this record to support that finding, although it's not before you at this stage, but to the extent of the concern, there's only
just, is there any difference between a stockbroker and a relative?
There is. This stock being in her safe deposit box could not be transferred except by Mr. McKinney's going out to her house and performing the function of a transfer agent. And so
that is the only way it can be transferred?
That's the only way that this stock could have been transferred under these circumstances where you've got a homebound person, it's not already in an account. The way that it had to be done was Mr. McKinney went out, met with her.
She signed the transfer.
She signed letters of authorization and the stock certificates.
And then could her nephew have taken those down to a transfer agent and had them transferred?
No, because her signature, and this is the crucial thing, under the Uniform Commercial Code, a stockbroker performing the function of a transfer agent warrants the legal capacity of the transferor, and that is required. Without that warranty done by a person like Mr. McKinney or like a bank who has the legal authority and responsibility to do that, that stock cannot be negotiated. It cannot be transferred. It's not fungible. And so the difference, the big difference between Bo and Pat is that Bo had that authority and responsibility and Pat did not. And Bo has the knowledge in his four-hour meeting with her that she didn't understand the transaction. She couldn't even read. She had glaucoma. He didn't read the stock transactions to her. She didn't read the documents. There were 20-plus documents, none of which she read, and she couldn't read them. And she was confused.
Would your rule apply to the notary notarized signature on the transfer of car title? Would it apply to notary on any, tax preparer's report to the IRS? Anybody, would this duty go to anybody who attests to the signature of someone who appears in front of them? I've got the duty to assess their competence to sign this document. If they're not competent to sign this document, then I'm liable if somebody defrauds them.
I don't think that the same argument can be made as strongly in the case of the notary, which I have considered and talked with my partner about because he's a notary. And the difference is...
What's the difference? The amount of time? Would it be a breach of duty if I don't spend enough time with them to be able to assess them? Or is it only a breach of duty if as a matter of fact, I spent time with them and so I should have otherwise identified it? Where does the breach occur?
I think the difference is in the nature of the duty. The notary's office does not involve a warranty of legal capacity. Bo McKinney's office, in performing the function that he performed, without which the stock could not have been transferred, involves a warranty of legal capacity. And Roy Mauer, who is a practicing securities attorney, the defendant's expert witness, a former securities commissioner, testified at trial that the broker must satisfy himself that his customer is competent or he is negligent. And Mr. McKinney admitted that.
Who is suing the broker for this breach of the legal capacity? Is it the person who received the stock and then lost the stock because she was declared incompetent, or is it the person who said she shouldn't have been allowed to transfer? It seems to me the warranty doesn't run to the person who signed the stock certificate. It runs to somebody else. So
we haven't sued on a breach of warranty.
So how does that create some sort of... Is this some sort of like a good faith, fair dealing that just sort of follows this contract but goes the opposite direction from the warranty? Or?
I think it's just one of the factors. And you asked what was the difference between the notary and the broker, and I said that's one factor that I think clearly distinguishes the two. But I think the duty arises from two things with respect to the stock transfers. The first thing it arises from is from the voluntary undertaking, which he was obligated to perform using ordinary care. And given this record that he should
voluntary
have
voluntary undertaking was he volunteered to go to her house to be with her. Is that the voluntary
to thing? Perform the function of a transfer agent? That was a voluntary undertaking. He had no customer relationship, no contract,
was
no account.
Was Mr. McKinney the actual transfer agent?
Yes, Your Honor, he was.
He could have done it without sending it to Edward Jones. Who's the transfer?
He's the transfer agent, and he works for Edward D. Jones, and so once he's transferred the stock and it gets deposited into an Edward D. Jones account, then Edward D. Jones or any other broker can deal with it, just like a street account. That's the way that works. But the second reason that there's a duty, Your Honor, just to get back to your question about where the duty arises, is that in response to question number 4, this jury also found that Mr. McKinney employed a fraudulent, manipulative, or deceptive device defined, among other things, as taking advantage of a person's lack of knowledge. That's straight out of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. And as Justice Cornyn's concurring opinion points out in one of the recent duty cases, when a person violates a statutory duty, at least he is negligent. He may be negligent per se. When the statute was designed for the protection of the class of people to which the plaintiff belongs, and so that's where we fit. Aunt B is in the class of people that the Securities Exchange Act was designed to protect, and it was designed to protect her, at least the portion that the jury answered in the affirmative on, against this very sort of conduct that took advantage of her lack of knowledge. So the duty in this instance arises from the voluntary undertaking and the violation of the statutory duty. The UCC warranty, I think, is important because it flatly refutes their argument that somehow that just wasn't a part of his job. It's clear that that was part of his job. It's in the statute. It's also clear from the Securities Exchange Commissioner's testimony, the expert for the defendants, that that was part of his job, and Mr. McKinney admitted that it was part of his job. It's not part of the notary's job, and that's why I wanted to distinguish between those two.
The parties have briefed the case extensively, and I assume thoroughly. In footnote 7 of the petitioner's brief, a number of cases are cited for the suggestion that in similar circumstances to these, there is no responsibility or legal duty on the part of a broker. And your brief tries to distinguish those cases, but cites no case to the contrary. Is there such a case in the country that would hold a broker under these circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor, I think there are cases that would hold a broker under these circumstances, and I would be happy to cite those to the court at this time. The first is a federal case out of the Western District Western District of Missouri, and that citation is, the case is Smith versus Smith Barney Harris. I'm sorry, Your Honor. It's the Kidder Peabody case. Let me give you the citation. 505 Bedsup 1380, and it's based upon a Missouri Supreme Court case that basically says there's a common law duty of ordinary care when you're on notice of suspicious circumstances, which is just common sense. I haven't cited those cases in the brief, but I did find those. I also found a case in which, and that's the Lichtenstein case out of the Western District of Pennsylvania, 840 Bedsup 374, where a husband and wife account, and the husband starts doing funny business with the wife's account, and the broker had knowledge from his dealings with the husband that should have alerted him to the funny business. And the court said, you know, common law ordinary care is required. And I think that's just common sense. The cases in footnote 7 on that page, Your Honor, are suitability cases. And those cases involve investments. This was not an investment. Aunt B gave away virtually all of her net worth when she was incompetent, when she was exhibiting signs of that incompetence that the broker knew or should have known were signs of incompetence. And there was no investment. The suitability cases don't apply.
Assuming she could have done so over the telephone, though, you're saying that absent some manifestation of her incompetency, Mr. McKinney would have no liability. Is that right?
I'm saying that on this record, that the court can, without any pangs of conscience, acknowledge the duty of ordinary care because of the knowledge he acquired in his four-hour meeting.
But without that knowledge, then no liability. She could be just as incompetent, but without something putting him on notice of the inquiry, he would be scot-free.
Well, that may be true. That case is not before you. I think that I would say that on this record, the duty that we are advocating, it stops outside the case you posit, because it was the knowledge that Mr. McKinney had in his four-hour meeting with her, together with the types of duties that he had as part of his job, together with his voluntary undertaking and his violation of the statute, that create the duty in this case. And I don't see any of those factors in the hypothetical that you're
posing. And the only evidence of Ms. Carnes' apparent incompetency during that meeting is from Mr. McKinney's testimony?
No, that's not true. Croucher versus Croucher is a Texas Supreme Court case. In that case, the court held that evidence before and after the adjudication of incompetency is evidence of incompetency. It's a 1983 case. I'm sorry, I don't have a citation in my notes.
So even if there were not manifestations of incompetency at the time, you're saying if she was incompetent before and was incompetent after, that would be some evidence of her incompetency at the time that would create a duty on Mr. McKinney?
No, I'm analogizing from that case that evidence that she exhibited signs of her incompetency before and after the meeting is some evidence that she exhibited them on that occasion, together with the medical evidence that we had medical records that say 8 months before the stock transaction, it's especially in the evenings, she was disoriented and confused that she couldn't even understand simple instructions from her nurses about when to eat and when not to eat. We had the lay evidence from the relatives that throughout 1989, when they met with her for longer than 30 minutes, she displayed confusion, forgetfulness, lack of knowledge, disorientation, and evidence that she was not with it. We had the evidence of the experts, one psychiatrist and one psychologist, who both opined that because of her physical condition, based upon their training and experience, she would have exhibited signs of incapacity on September 28, 1989, during a four-hour meeting with a stockbroker about this kind of transaction, especially given that it was a disruption of her normal routine. This meeting lasted for several hours past her bedtime. So we have plenty of evidence in the record that on the occasion in question she did exhibit the signs, and this court, I submit, is required to indulge in that inference and that presumption in support of the jury findings, unlike your other no-duty cases, which were summary dispositions.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Justice Gorman, if I could, let me follow up on what you said. The evidence of what Bo McKinney saw on the night of the stock transfer is contained wholly in the testimony of Bo McKinney and Ms. Ennis. They were the only two people present who testified, and they testified that she was bright, that she was alert, that she told Mr. McKinney when he came in she'd been expecting him to be there, that she was asked several times during the course of the evening whether she wished to continue. She was asked the question whether this is what she wanted to do. And in every one of those instances, she responded affirmatively. Counsel says, well, under Croucher v. Croucher, though if I proved that she was incompetent beforehand and I proved she was incompetent afterwards, then it is inferable from that that she would have demonstrated signs of incompetence in her meeting with Bo McKinney. I don't think that's what Croucher holds. What Croucher holds is if you have evidence before an event that a certain state exists and evidence after the event that that same state exists, it's reasonable to infer that that state continued to exist in the interim. That's not the same question. Yes, ma'am.
On the duty issue, does UCC Section Exhibit 803 create a duty on the behalf of the stock transfer to determine legal, including mental capacity?
We've looked at that. I think there's one case. I think what capacity means there is that if I sign this as trustee of the Joe Jones Trust, that is in fact my capacity. What I am doing in the Uniform Commercial Code, Justice Owen, I believe, is I am certifying to that signature in order to give the transferee of that security the confidence that they are acquiring title. Now, the fact of the matter is, I think when they're arguing this, it seems strange to me that they would be arguing it, because that warranty does not run to Aunt B. Cairns. It doesn't run to her other heirs and devisees. It runs to the transferee of the security. And what it says is that if we're wrong on this and you lose the title, you sue us on a breach of warranty. And we then must respond to you for your loss in that security. It has not anything to do with the question of whether he owed a duty to Ms. B. Cairns.
Do you think that McKinney could be liable if in this dealing it turned out that Aunt B. was a mongoloid, or Aunt B. had other signs of serious mental incapacity, mental retardation?
Your Honor, I still believe we've got a process for that in this state. If there is someone who is incompetent to handle their affairs, somebody in Ms. Fletcher's position or something else does what she finally did in 90, although saying she thought she was out of her mind since 86, you go into a court, you put on evidence. Before you deprive that person of the right to utilize their property as they see fit, and before you put all the people that deal with them at risk, I think that's the reason we have the procedures. And I know you, all of you, have sat in cases where the question of incompetence is battled back and forth between highly paid doctors, and they can't even agree. And lawyers don't agree on what the particular competence is in the transaction. And what they seek to do here is to say, Bo McKinney should have known.
But that aside, let's just assume all right, that for whatever reason, there's never been a legal determination of competency.
Right.
And McKinney is dealing with someone who is obviously mentally retarded. Should there be any reason why he should be held liable?
No, sir, I don't believe there is, because I think this is a place where you've got to decide how you're going to cut it. He may be running the risk that he's going to expose himself to liability from a transferee, and he may decide for his own good, out of his own good business sense, I'm not going to do that deal. But I don't think that sort of decision is the same as saying, but you're also going to be liable to the person for whom you transfer it. But I think, I do believe in this instance, you need a bright line. And there are procedures available that will say this person can no longer, is no longer capable of handling their own affairs. Now, if I could, I think there's some confusion here. Bo McKinney was not a transfer agent. Bo McKinney is acting like a commercial banker, a trust company, or a registered stockbroker in guaranteeing the signature of B. Cairns on these stock certificates so they can be transferred. The transfer agent, Justice Baker, is located in St. Louis or wherever the company is. Most of them, I think, are located on the street in New York where there is a bank, and they determine whether they have appropriate papers to transfer and whether they have the appropriate assurance of authenticity of signature, and then they're transferred on the books and records of the corporation. And most of them, as a matter of fact, I think now go through seed in companies, so they never, the stock certificates and anything really never get transferred. It's just a matter of a checklist for authenticity. So Bo McKinney is not acting as a transfer agent. Any banker, any commercial banker in those counties could have been in the same position. Any officer of a trust company could be in this same position. I think the question that was asked, I think Justice Enoch asked it, and that is, what's the difference with a notary? Or what is the difference with a witness to a will? Are they civilly liable if they make them, if they miscall them? That's what we're talking about in this case, and counsel can say it's different with a stockbroker, but let's go back to the question. What is the broker doing here? He is acting in standard agency position, and he owes his principal the duty to follow the principal's instruction.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yes, sir.
Based on your argument, he is not a transfer agent. He was acting to guarantee the signature of business terms on the certificate. Are there definitions of who and what capacity they have to be a guarantor? In other words, there's a limited scope of people.
I believe that there are regulations. As a matter of fact, I think the respondents cited them in their rejoinder to our reply or response, whatever it was. I think they cited some CFR citations in there along with the UCC citations. I believe, and I may be wrong, Justice Baker, I think all those say is that a transfer agent must accept those people's attestation. I think a transfer agent, if they choose to do so, they're free to honor the transfer, whether it's done that way or not. If they do that, however, I believe they're going to take on the liability if, in fact, there's something wrong with the signature, as opposed to being able to look back down the chain to the guarantor. Did I respond?
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
That concludes the arguments for today, and all the arguments we've heard today will be submitted. All briefs and oral arguments, the marshal will adjourn the court.
Oh, yeah.